In Christianity, convert baptism is a relationship, not an event. I'm not saying it should be a relationship. Convert baptism is always a relationship of one kind to another. At its most divine, convert baptism is an I-thou relationship of spiritual intimacy. At its most mortal, convert baptism is an I-it relationship of commodity acquisition. Often it is some mixture of the two. In both the I-thou and I-it relationship, the baptizer is either an itinerant evangelist or missionary, or a pastoral evangelist missionary. At the extreme, the itinerant missionary is with the convert only long enough to say a few words and baptize her or him. Then the missionary goes on to other fields white for the harvest. The Apostle Paul was such a missionary to most of the converts he baptized in the Roman Empire. At the other extreme, pastoral missionaries devote their lives to personally nurturing each convert they have baptized. Franciscan priests were that kind of evangelist to each Native American convert they baptized in the Adobe missions of the American Southwest. Because of the temporary nature of Mormon missionary service, at best an LDS missionary can only be a mixture of itinerant and pastor. Depending on their personality and circumstances, many Mormon missionaries never give pastoral attention to the persons they baptize. In either role, however, the missionary can participate in conversion as a relationship of spiritual intimacy, or can participate in baptism as merely a way to gain something earthly. In the I-thou relationship, convert baptism signifies reciprocal love and glorification. Jesus of Nazareth proclaimed, "For I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly." The personal God of Mormonism declared, "For this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man." God's purpose for being is to advance the experience and fulfillment of his daughters and sons. As for the spiritual convert, she or he takes on Christ through baptism and becomes a new person in the Savior. In Mormon doctrine, the convert becomes the spiritually adopted daughter or son of Christ. In this I-thou relationship, the convert also enters a new relationship of spiritual sisterhood and brotherhood with all the others who are in this household of faith. In an I-thou relationship, the missionary aids conversion by drawing on the powers of the divine to reach out in love to the prospective convert. The personal welfare and future prospects of the convert are the first priority for the missionary who participates in I-thou conversions. A Book of Mormon missionary said, "And we have suffered all manner of afflictions and all this, that perhaps we might be the means of saving some soul." Personal benefit to missionaries from the convert baptism is not a goal of their I-thou proselytizing. One missionary may baptize a single I-thou convert in 2 years, while another may baptize thousands of I-thou converts. On the other hand, in the I-it relationship, baptism is a means for the convert to gain something earthly. The convert who is unhappy may want the happiness that seems to surround the missionaries and members of the new faith. The lonely may seek the instant friendships that seem to be the reward for conversion. Dysfunctional or shattered families may seek transformation into the happy marriages they see at invitational family home evenings or in home front television commercials. The hungry and ill may desperately want the food and health care that are available to the worthy poor of the new church. The impoverished may hope to achieve financial opportunities through association with comparatively wealthy missionaries and members of the new church. Social outcasts may crave what they perceive as the respectability surrounding members of the new church, especially if they know converts who have experienced upward social mobility.
In I-it conversions, the uprooted and dislocated may also need the stability and cohesiveness of the new church's social network. Those who envy or identify with the United States may seek vicarious Americanization through association with U.S. missionaries and their Americanized converts. Students in specific countries may seek the tuition-free education available to them from the church's large university, which is trying to build bridges across which Mormon missionaries can march someday into previously forbidden cities. Illegal immigrants to the United States may accept baptism from a missionary who promises not to report them to the INS, and who offers to transport them to destinations far from the border. And, in the main subject of this essay, disadvantaged children and teenagers may be eager to be dunked underwater as the only requirement for a free trip to the beach or for membership in a sports club sponsored by a church. In the I-It relationship, performing baptisms is also a means for the missionary to gain something earthly. The missionary may want the praise of family and church leaders for adding converts to the faith. Some missionaries use convert baptism as a way to get the personal testimony of the gospel that was absent in their pre-mission experience. The missionary may seek a sense of self-worth through baptizing others. Missionaries may believe that their eternal glory grows with each new convert. Missionaries may think that God's love for them actually increases with each person they bring into His kingdom. The missionary may expect that performing more baptisms will increase the chances of advancement in church office. The missionary may enjoy the rush of competing with other missionaries who can baptize the most persons, or which mission can out-baptize the other missions of the world. And again, in the main subject of this essay, there's seats over there. In the main subject of this essay, church leaders may put such intense pressures of reward or disfavor on a missionary's baptismal numbers that young missionaries will do anything, to satisfy those demands. In all of the above examples of I-IT missionary work, potential converts or actual converts are only objects to fulfill the various goals of a missionary. This essay tells the story of a specific period in the modern history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It began as a program to encourage I-Thou conversions to Mormonism, but rapidly degenerated into an I-IT race for baptism numbers. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, many LDS leaders promoted this as a new era of missionary work and referred to it as the Youth Baptism Program. In the 1970s, LDS Church President Spencer W. Kimball derided it as, quote, the kiddie baptism program, unquote. For the first time in 1973, I gave a detailed summary of this history as part of a 35-page interview with the Historical Department of the LDS Church. I put it under a 20-year restriction, which has now passed. In many missions, this accelerated baptism program was known by whatever activity the missionaries used to attract adolescent boys. Young males were the specific target because of this new era missionary program, because the program sought to change the previous overrepresentation of females in conversions and active membership, and the consequent marriage of many of those active young women to non-Mormon males. In some missions, its nickname was basketball program. In others, it was the beach party program. In Great Britain and continental Europe, it was popularly known as the baseball baptism program. That's the most common nickname for the entire era and the entire approach, although, as I point out, in different missions, there were different sports programs used. Henry D. Moyle was the architect of the new era in the church as soon as he became a counselor in the First Presidency. This was linked with the fact that the LDS Church issued its last public statement of expenditures at the April 1959 conference. Appointed second counselor 2 months later, Moyle assumed direction of church finances with President David O. McKay's optimistic encouragement. Counselor Moyle immediately set aside the current budget and launched a massive increase in expenditures, especially in the construction of new buildings. 6 months later, the church had spent $8 million more than it received in 1959. This was extraordinary when compared to the church's surplus income of $7 million after 1958's expenditures. Because the last published report of expenditures included the building program, Moyle persuaded President McKay not to publish even an abbreviated accounting of church spending. There was no itemized financial report of church expenditures from 1960 onward. Henry D. Moyle's financial program for the LDS Church was fundamentally linked with his missionary program. First, he expected a major increase of tithing revenues from a significant rise in convert baptisms. Second, he was convinced that massive increases in church membership meant there would soon be thousands of Mormons in towns and cities where now there were only a few dozen. Therefore, Counselor Moyle ordered the church building program to construct meeting houses for that projected growth, rather than for the current needs of thousands of small branches throughout the world. particularly in continental Europe and Great Britain. This massive building program plunged the LDS Church into huge spending deficits. At the time, Apostle Harold B. Lee waged a losing battle in what he called, quote, "My stubborn resistance to the principle of deficit spending, supposedly justified in the hope of increasing the tithing of the church to cover the deficit," unquote. Such an increase in the building program required a virtual explosion in the number of tithe payers to avoid bankrupting the church. In effect, this left the church's financial survival directly in the hands of youthful full-time missionaries. The nickname of New Era for this missionary program was linked to church finances, to David O. McKay, and to Great Britain. The First Presidency's financial secretary had proclaimed in the mid-1950s that projected increases of tithing revenues constituted, quote, "a new era in the financial history of the church," unquote. After the dedication of the London Temple in September 1958, the British mission president also altered President McKay's dedicatory remarks to read, "This is a new era in the British mission," and published that quote, which was not exactly what President McKay had said. By 1961, Henry D. Moyle's missionary program in Great Britain and elsewhere involved seven memorized proselytizing lessons instead of the previous plan, which required 18 lessons before convert baptism in Great Britain. That varied from mission to mission, but in Great Britain it had been 18. The New Era missionary plan had a challenge for baptism at the end of the first lesson. Crucial to Moyle's missionary program were baptism quotas, an emphasis on baptizing young males, whom he expected to become tithe-paying breadwinners and heads of LDS families. In tandem with the new era of missionary work, Moyle's protege, Wendell Mendenhall, was chairman of the Church Building Committee, and Mendenhall accelerated church construction worldwide from 1959 onward. For example, in 1960, the two men addressed a meeting of mission presidents, missionaries, and local leaders in Manchester, England. They praised the missionaries for using baseball instruction to baptize young boys, and for accepting goals to double the current year's number of baptism. They also explained that this rate of growth required the church to complete a new meeting house every day in Great Britain alone. To assist this accelerated building effort in 1960, the church began having young men serve two-year building missions in Britain and continental Europe. This had double benefits in providing cheap labor for constructing chapels and also in keeping the teenage boys active in the church, nearly all of them converted without their parents. Nevertheless, even with voluntary labor, the construction of new meeting houses almost single-handedly pushed the church to a $32 million deficit for 1962. Moyle's building program assumed long-term population growth of extraordinary proportions, yet paying for it required immediate tithing increases. Quote, "I wonder where all the money will come from," the 12's president wrote. By the end of 1963, there was already a shortfall of by the end of February 1963, only 2 months into the year, there was already a shortfall of $5 million, and the year threatened to equal or exceed the LDS Church's spending deficit for the previous year. Mormonism was teetering on the edge of a financial crisis by mid-1963. Long before then, the building program alone had made it imperative to baptize large numbers of adolescent boys to become building missionaries and tithe payers. Moyle told British missionaries, quote, "We need these young men. How are we going to get this labor missionary program carried out without them? The answer is, we could not," unquote. However, shortly after the baseball baptisms began, some missionaries in Britain wrote letters to the church president with complaints that the program was exploiting British youth. First Presidency secretaries had routed these letters to the counselor in charge of missionary work, Henry D. Moyle. A man of strong will and quick temper, Counselor Moyle lashed out at these letters in his talk to all British missionaries in November 1960. Quote, "You elders need have no concern, no matter from what source the criticism comes, as to whether your baptisms are too fast. If you think that President McKay does not know what is going on, and that Brother Moyle and Brother Woodbury and Brother Brockbank are pulling a fast one, so to speak, You are mistaken about that. I have noticed a little apologetic tone in some of your voices about baptizing too many young people. Well, don't put on the brakes, unquote. Moy published those remarks in the Church News. Moy's counsel that missionaries should ignore criticism, no matter from what source, referred to the apostles, who were already criticizing the baptism program and its worldwide spin-offs. For example, in March 1960, Apostle Harold B. Lee had warned the missionaries in France that, quote, conversions are not merely the result of a system, not merely the result of a machine operation. We are not concerned primarily with how many baptisms you get, unquote. In September, Moyle confided that Apostles Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee were, quote, in real opposition to his accelerated missionary program, unquote. The European Mission President, Alvin R. Dyer, also told missionaries in France of the criticism of the accelerated baptisms he heard when he was at October 1960 General Conference. In December 1960, Counselor Moyle formally announced to the apostles that baseball was now a missionary tool to baptize teenage boys, and he emphasized that this was happening particularly in England and the continental Europe. Convert numbers soared. General Authority Derek A. Cuthbert has written, quote, instead of baptizing ones and twos, almost overnight from mid-1960, the missionaries were bringing in tens and hundreds, unquote. He is an English general authority who continues to defend the baseball baptism program publicly. In 1959, Great Britain and continental Europe baptized a total of 9% of all baptisms of the LDS Church. A year later, Britain and Europe accounted for 36% of the entire church's baptisms. Soon, missionaries were competing with each other to achieve quotas, and each mission president throughout the world was competing to have the highest number of baptisms. However, many general authorities had misgivings, especially about Great Britain, where several apostles had served missions. By May 1961, quote, nearly all of the apostles were gravely concerned about the pressures being put on missionaries to baptize to fill a quota of baptisms, unquote. BYU's president added, quote, this, of course, was a criticism of President Moyle and many of the mission presidents working under his direction, unquote. Rather than consider the merits of such criticism from the Quorum of the Twelve, Moyle publicly counterattacked. In August 1961, he had the Church News publish the full text of his defense of the New Era missionary program. He lashed out against persons who, quote, undertake to sow doubt or uncertainty about any phase of missionary work, which equaled criticism of our head, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, unquote. He denied that missionaries were overworked. He even instructed parents and church leaders to ignore letters from youthful missionaries who complained about any aspect of the new missionary program. So that no one would understand, Counselor Moyle referred to, quote, these teenage baptisms, about which there seems to have been so much talk. Unquote. He said it was no one's business to complain if a boy chose to be baptized on the first day or the first week or whenever contacted. Counselor Moyle also encouraged mission presidents and missionaries to regard convert baptisms like scores in athletic competition. As an example of this officially sponsored competitiveness, the Church News reported in September 1961 that so far in the year, quote, the Northwestern States Mission, about which I'll speak later, leads the missions. Samoa missionaries were in second place. California Mission reported 2,138 converts to clinch third place, unquote. Reading like the sports page, the Church News reported in December that the Scottish-Irish missions, quote, baptisms could well exceed 5,100 for the year, the highest of any mission. The Northwestern States Mission, with 4,000 baptisms by the end of October, will run the Scottish-Irish a close second, with the estimated 4,000 to 5,000 for the third year. Contending for third spot will be the Samoan mission, unquote. With little or no gospel instruction, pre-adolescent and teenage boys were joining the LDS Church by tens of thousands annually throughout the world. As a 17-year-old, I listened to the homecoming in my Southern California ward for a missionary who said he had baptized over 200 teenage boys in the Pacific Northwest. I regarded that as faith-promoting until a few years later when I listened to the complaints of a bishop from the Portland area. His ward clerk was swamped with membership certificates for dozens of boys that no one in the ward had met. After the bishop began locating them, he heard an identical story. A pair of LDS missionaries had played basketball with the boys who were usually underprivileged or from single-parent homes. The elders told them of free trips throughout the Northwest to compete against LDS ward teams and of the all-church tournament in Salt Lake City for the best basketball teams, all paid for by the church. The only catch, missionaries told the boys that they had to be baptized in the LDS church in order to play on the athletic teams. After the baptism ceremony, usually on the first day of contact, the missionaries gave the boys the time and place of local LDS meetings. These Portland area boys never saw those elders again. A Mississippi convert described a variation on this approach in the Gulf States Mission in the early 1960s. Their missionary sisters and elders combed upcountry towns and hamlets for boys who had never seen the ocean or the Gulf of Mexico. During the several-hour bus or car ride to the beach, the missionaries taught the boys all six discussions at once. When they reached the sugar-white sands of the Gulf, the first order of business was multiple baptism ceremonies in the gently lapping surf. Otherwise, the vehicle would turn immediately around and take the boys back home. After the unsurprising baptismal service, after hours of fun in the sun, the newly baptized learned that the missionaries would be glad to bring them back to the beach again, if each boy brought along at least one unbaptized friend. Quote, "I was one of those white-trashed kids," the southern boy drawled, "and now I'm one of the beach party baptism success stories," unquote. He was a full-time missionary when he told me his experience. A speaker at Brigham Young University's devotional in 1962-63 school year startled the audience by criticizing another example of the New Era missionary work. A pair of elders visited a playground in the eastern states and offered an ice cream soda to every boy over the age of eight who would accept baptism that afternoon. I listened to this as a freshman student and prospective missionary and wondered how it was possible for missionaries to do that. By the fall of 1963, I was in England and began to learn what had happened in the British missionaries during the previous 5 years. Almost 2 years earlier, in January 1962, 70s President Marion D. Hanks began to preside over mission headquarters in London. He had personal instructions from President Mackay. Quote, "I have heard disturbing rumors about what is going on in the British mission," the church president said. "If there are excesses, I want you to correct them," unquote. Hanks immediately ended baptism quotas and stopped the baseball program, which cut baptisms drastically in his mission. This resulted in criticism of Hanks by Moyle at church headquarters, by presidents of the other missions, which now existed in Britain, and by missionaries and local English leaders within the British mission itself. Elder Cuthbert was the mission counselor in charge of trying to fellowship these thousands of English boys into the church. He has written to defend the baseball baptism program, which, quote, "has become a derogatory term among many people," unquote. His only comment about the termination of the baseball baptisms was to say that newly arrived President Hanks, quote, "gave us some breathing space before moving forward again," unquote. Ironically, it was a non-Mormon historian, a British historian, who noted that Hanks, quote, "responded to the baseball baptisms of youths by placing the real emphasis not on baptism as such as a goal, but on that conversion of life, which is a longer-term process," unquote. In January 1963, Apostle Mark E. Peterson arrived to preside over the missions throughout Britain, Ireland, and French East. Henry D. Moyle, Jr. had presided over the French East since 1961, and his first missionary bulletin outlined the program for Baseball American. President Peterson complained that, quote, "baseball baptisms were being made whereby youngsters were baptized into the church without any instruction and sometimes without the knowledge of or consent of their parents," unquote. He added, quote, "Under President Mackay's instructions, we were to discontinue such things and bring the missions back to a normal proselyting program," unquote. In contrast to Apostle Peterson, Cuthbert's official British missions history said that the conduct of the baseball baptism program required that, quote, "parents must agree in writing to the baptizing of their children," unquote. Cuthbert's claim was based on the official requirement for LDS baptism of minors. Peterson's statement referred to what had happened in reality, which I'll soon discuss. What can I say? The principal architect of the baseball baptism program in Britain was Moyle's protege, T. Bowring, nicknamed Bo Woodbury. President Woodbury led the British mission from August 1958 to January 1962, and Elder Cuthbert served as his English counselor. Woodbury apparently had been in consultation with Apostle Moyle about this program for a year before Moyle entered the first presidency. Other mission presidents who were involved in this program to a lesser extent were Bernard P. Brockbank in the North British Mission and Scottish Mission from 1960 to 1962, and James A. Cullimore in the Central British Mission from 1961 to 1963. N. Eldon Tanner, then an assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve, also presided over the French East Mission and all the British missions from his headquarters near the London Temple from 1961 to 1962. The baseball baptism program was at its height when Tanner told supervising elders to follow the instructions of their mission presidents, quote, without question, unquote. He told General Conference of October 1961 that in England, quote, we are baptizing enough new members every 2 months to create a stake of more than 2,500 people, unquote. The official conference report toned down Tanner's estimate from 6 new stakes annually to, quote, we are baptizing in the British Isles alone enough people for 4 or 5 stakes each year, unquote. Alvin R. Dyer, also an assistant to the 12, vigorously advocated the youth baptism program while he was presiding over the LDS missions on the European continent. For example, Dyer told the French missionaries in 1961, quote, you can teach or make statements of everything that a person needs to join to be baptized in this church in less than 3 minutes, unquote. Woodbury had served as Dyer's counselor in the Central States Mission from 1954 to 1958. I gained my knowledge of what happened during Britain's baseball baptism program through interviews with some of President Woodbury's missionaries, with English bishops and branch presidents, and with mission presidents who served in the post-baseball baptism era. As a counterbalance to how T. Bowring Woodbury contributed to the excesses of the baseball baptism program, I must emphasize that all local British leaders I met felt near adoration for him. President Woodbury was devoted to the youth missionary program and youth baptism program. During his 3.5 years over the British mission, President Woodbury took personal responsibility for many of the teenage boys who were baptized in the baseball baptism program. He spent tens of thousands of dollars of his personal wealth to support dozens of these boys as building missionaries in their early teens and to support them as full-time missionaries in their late teens. Brits could be full-time missionaries at age 17. I met one of these young men while he was attending Oxford University. He had been among the, quote, scruffy, unquote, Cockney boys that the missionaries had recruited as baseball baptisms from the row houses of South London. President Woodbury also used his personal funds to subsidize struggling branches and to implement missionary programs that were beyond the budget of church funds. Despite such positive contributions, Woodbury also created the world of frenzy and stress for his British missionaries. Behind Councillor Moyle's public denials that missionaries were overworked was their crushing schedule in the British mission and probably elsewhere. President Woodbury told his missionaries that they needed only 5 hours of sleep a night. At 7 a.m., they were to be out on the streets looking for people to baptize. They were to schedule their last teaching appointment or baptism ceremony at midnight. Moyle reaffirmed that policy in at least one talk he gave to all the British missionaries at the Hyde Park Chapel. The New Era, Woodbury's monthly publication, missionary publication, emphasized quotas, baptism statistics, and that it was the spirit, not the missionary's words, which converted. The implication was that the missionary was only an instrument of baptism, not a teacher of the gospel. Missionaries who reached their baptism quotas were honored as the Golden Missionary of the Month. Achieving increased goals merited membership in the Convert of a Month Club, the Four or More Club, the Extra Mile Club, the Family a Month Club, and the 100%er Club. In addition, President Woodbury took the best baptizers to dinner. For having the highest numbers of baptisms in a week, he invited two missionaries to have dinner at the mission home where they sat at the head of the table. For consistently exceeding baptism quotas, President Woodbury hosted the top baptizers at the best restaurants in London. But the baptism quotas kept escalating. In 1958, Woodbury set a goal of 1,250 baptisms in the mission for the next year. In 1961, he set the baptism goal at 14,000. To put that increase in perspective, it's necessary to recognize that three other missions had been created out of the original British mission by that time. Therefore, Woodbury increased baptism goals more than 10 times beyond their 1958 level, even though his mission now had only about a fourth of the territory and population it had in 1958, and fewer missionaries. In May 1960, mission headquarters sent all missionaries a special badge, which they were supposed to wear to weekly British missionary meetings, but only if they had baptized one or more persons the previous month. Now, by the personal experience of some of the people in this audience who have served in missions in various parts of the world, one or two persons a month would be a very low goal. However, by pre-Woodbury experience in Britain, one baptism per missionary per month was a major achievement. However, British missionary meetings now resembled pep rallies or a football coach's browbeating at halftime. All the attention was on those missionaries who were not wearing their badges. In July-August 1960, Brockbank's North British mission combined with Woodbury's mission to reach a combined goal of 1,000 convert baptisms in honor of David O. McKay's birthday. Their 1,110 baptisms for those 2 months were almost equal to their previous year's total for all of Great Britain. In November 1960, Woodbury announced that there would be a mission tour to Mormon historic sites in England, and then to the London Temple, so that missionaries could re-experience the sacred endowment ceremony. The only missionaries who could go on this grand trip were those who baptized four persons during the next month. The British Mission's New Era used slogans to promote this award. All of these are quotes. "Find your four souls on the double, then let's see the river ribble. You'll find your four, and then you'll hasten to the temple. Baptize four and get some thrills by going to the Malvern Hills. First baptize four, this is the rule, then let's meet in Liverpool. And finally, lean on the Lord's arm to take you to Benbow's farm." Afterwards, the entire issue of the Mission magazine featured photographs of the missionaries who went on this excursion and descriptions of what they did. General Authority Alvin R. Dyer officially encouraged mission presidents in the European mission to use an invitation to the temple as a way to prod missionaries to achieve baptism quotas. In his 1962 The Challenge, published by the Church's Deseret Book Company, Dyer referred to, quote, the mission president in Frankfurt, Germany, who had proposed that if they got four baptisms in December, they could go to the temple as the guest of the mission president over the Christmas holidays, unquote. Dyer then told of two missionaries who had no one to baptize on December 22nd, but, quote, who baptized four people in 3 days and went to the temple with their mission president, unquote. Woodbury launched another contest for the British mission in 1961. It had two planks. First, to honor your mother, baptize four converts. Second, by so honoring your mother, you will be allowed to attend the dedication of the Hyde Park Chapel in London and be able to see the church president. Those who failed to reach that baptism quota didn't simply lose the opportunity to see the prophet. By implication, these missionaries had also dishonored their mothers. This was the message of the February 1961 New Era. Quote, to meet our dear prophet will be quite a treat, but we must honor mother before we all meet, unquote. In addition, Woodbury and other mission presidents throughout Britain and continental Europe set mass baptism drives for Moyle Month and McKay Month. President Woodbury's baptism quotas involved punishments as well as rewards, which some of his missionaries described to me. If missionaries had baptized the highest numbers for the week's or month's goal, Woodbury called them by their first names when he met or wrote them. That was a clear violation of church-wide missionary rules. He called the missionaries elder or sister if they baptized only the average for the week or month. One of Woodbury's missionaries, who was a teaching assistant with me in BYU's religion department when I was an undergraduate there, described what happened when a missionary baptized less than the average mandated by mission headquarters. With only one baptism instead of the required four, this missionary happened to visit mission headquarters in London. "Hello, President Woodbury," he said as the elder put out his hand. Woodbury ignored the missionary, walked past him, and left the 20-year-old standing with his hand extended into empty space. Every missionary who baptized less than required was treated as a non-person by British mission headquarters. Thousands of miles from their home, British missionaries faced discrimination, loss of privileges, and even ostracism from the mission president and fellow missionaries, all for not baptizing enough new Mormons. And so came the excesses, the incredible excesses of the new youth baptism program in Britain. As elsewhere throughout the world, the British missionaries used the sports program, but with a difference. Quote, "If you want to play any more baseball with us," missionaries told the young Brits, "you'll have to join our club. And there's an initiation ceremony that's connected with our baseball club." Often baptized at the local YMCA, these British boys thought they had joined an American baseball club. Fronting as a baseball club was not a bizarre innovation, as I once thought it was, of British missionaries, but was an official part of the baseball baptism throughout Europe. In a conference with mission leaders from the French Mission, French East Mission, and Dutch Mission in April 1961, General Authority Alvin R. Dyer outlined each step of the program he had already implemented in Germany. He explained, quote, "After the initial baseball game, the young people are called together, preferably at the edge of the playing field, where the missionaries tell them who they are, and ask them to join a church group or club, and to return the following day, bringing their friends with them." One of the missionaries asked Elder Dyer, quote, "After getting the baseball team baptized, do you continue working with that team?" Answer, "No, sir. Your branch must do the integrating," unquote. The ultimate goal of the program was to baptize the entire family of each boy, and at the minimum to have written permission from the parents from each boy for his baptism into the church. However, in the headlong rush to meet baptism quotas, missionaries often avoided opposition by merely asking parents to give written permission for the boys to join a sports club. Missionaries couldn't always meet their quotas by baptizing those who were 8 years of age or older. Therefore, some elders baptized children who were 5, 6, or 7 years of age, and then forged their birth dates on the baptismal certificates. If they still hadn't baptized enough to get mission leaders off their necks, other missionaries baptized one boy several times under assumed names and filled baptismal certificates with plausible information. District leaders were under tremendous pressures to come up with baptismal statistics. The DL had to phone in reports of all baptisms performed by the missionaries in his district. Districts were in competition with one another, and a DL also had his individual quota for baptisms. Some district leaders simply forged baptismal certificates for non-existent people. Mission headquarters, of course, assumed these people existed, which took off some of the pressure from DLs. The English, Scottish, Irish, and Welsh underclass absorbed the brunt of the baseball baptism abuses in Britain. Families on the dole had been impressed by the slick-looking, smooth-talking American missionaries. Their children thought they had joined an athletic club, but later discovered that they were part of a church which made demands of them. Many parents were so bitter that they could hardly speak civilly to a Mormon. There were government-subsidized council house areas in towns and cities throughout Britain where the missionaries dared not go by the mid-1960s because the residents threw stones at them. That was not some pathological anti-Mormonism, but a direct result of the deceptive baptism of adolescent boys into a baseball club. Certainly neither Henry D. Moyle nor the mission presidents under his tutelage recognized what missionaries were really doing. In his talk which outlined the baseball club program to European missionaries, President Dyer cautioned, quote, "If we get 1,000 converts 1 month, and in the next month only 200 or 300 are active, we have not done a very good job," unquote. Mormon leaders thought they could impose incredible pressures on young missionaries without something snapping. The leaders were wrong. All Counselor Moyle and his supporters saw was the massive increase in baptisms and the illusion of spiritual growth. Although their critics within and without the church pointed to the abuses, a significant group of LDS leaders did not recognize the spiritual decay that lay under the surface. It was a spiritual malaise that the Mormon hierarchy had inadvertently created and was unknowingly perpetuating. By the summer of 1963, the church was in a crisis which resulted in the downfall of Counselor Moyle. As recently as 1957, Zions National Bank alone had $70 million in deposits of the church's once secure reserves. In 1963, only 5 years later, or I can't even count, I'm lost, 6 years later, the LDS church finances were so strained that, quote, church financial officers wondered if they would be able to meet the payroll, unquote. Then the New York Times reported in May 1963 that the Church of Scotland officially condemned the baseball baptism program as the LDS Church's, quote, most insidious approach, unquote. This negative publicity may have been the catalyst for a move to strip Counselor Moyle of his two major responsibilities, his portfolio, as one journalist put it. By July, President of the Quorum of the Twelve, Joseph Fielding Smith, was now criticizing, quote, the spending proclivities of President Moyle, also concerning the unorthodox way in which youngsters had been baptized in the church, unquote. The other counselor, Hubie Brown, explained that this resulted in downgrading of one of the counselors in the first presidency, and he died of a broken heart as a result of it, unquote. Relieved of his direction of church finances and of the missionary program, Henry D. Moyle died of a coronary in September 1963. It's certain that many missionaries during this period refused to compromise their ethics in order to meet quotas, to achieve awards, or even to avoid ostracism. I felt tremendous admiration as I listened to their experiences. It's also clear that many of those baptized during the baseball baptism era were real converts who remained devoted Mormons. I also met many of them. However, other missionaries could not resist the unrelenting pressures to become baptizing machines. As a result, thousands of unknowing, underage, untaught, or non-existent persons ended up on the membership rolls of the LDS Church in Great Britain. Worldwide, this amounted to tens of thousands of ill-prepared or deceived persons, mainly adolescent boys, who were baptized into the LDS Church from 1959 to 1963. Some might doubt that these abuses of the baseball baptism program were that common or widespread. Apostle Mark E. Peterson's presidency over the British Isles is a significant evidence of the extent of the problem. In the spring of 1964, he began a comprehensive program of excommunication throughout the British Isles, based on in-person interviews of every inactive person on the church's membership records. The first goal was to fellowship and teach all inactives all six of the church-wide proselyting discussions, which many of them had never received, as well as seven more fellowshipping lessons that Apostle Peterson himself provided. However, he instructed missionaries and local leaders to excommunicate everyone who could not be fellowshipped and who did not want to be LDS church members. Like other British missionaries in 1964, I helped conduct that survey in the branch where I lived. I spoke with many of the boys who thought they had merely joined a baseball club, or who were under 8 years old when they were baptized. There were also membership records with non-existent addresses, or with names of people who had never lived at the listed addresses. I was assigned to preside over another branch that had 8 active Mormons out of a membership roster of 150. I'll skip this in the interest of time and indicate that I, as a 20-year-old, conducted 4 mass baptism courts in my branch. The English bishop of one ward told me he excommunicated 150 baseball baptism boys in a 2-week period, and the end was not yet in sight. I just learned before this meeting, he told me this in the Celestial Room of the London Temple. He was at that time the temple recorder and assistant in the presidency of the temple. I just learned today that 25 years ago he rejoined the Church of England and became a priest in the Church of England. Such mass excommunications were happening in every ward and branch throughout the British Isles in the last months of 1964 and throughout most of 1965. Elder Cuthbert's History of the British Missions makes no reference to such results of the baseball program. However, he acknowledged in BYU Studies that, quote, we failed in our convert retention from 1960 to 1965, by which time the pendulum had swung too far, unquote. After which, continuing, quote, emphasis was placed on baptizing families rather than youth, unquote. Nevertheless, Cuthbert still insisted in that same article that, quote, the years 1960 to 1964 were a golden era for the British missions. By the way, under the direction of Apostle Peterson, the successors of all the baseball baptism mission presidents ended baptism quotas and pressures. This caused convert baptisms to drop in Britain and elsewhere drastically low. At the end of 1965, total membership in the LDS missions worldwide was 15,000 less than at the end of 1964. This was the largest decline in total mission field membership during any period of one year to another in Mormon history. Using sports to recruit adolescents had ended virtually church-wide by 1964, and so decreased baptisms do not account for mission field loss of membership from 1960. And so decreased baptisms do not account for mission field loss of membership from 1964 to 1965. Also, less than 5,000 can be accounted for by the formation of new stakes from missions in 1965. Therefore, there were so many mission field excommunications during 1965 that even new baptisms could not compensate numerically. Since the net loss was 10,000 persons that year, the total mission field excommunications numbered in the tens of thousands during 1965. The vast majority of these excommunications were undoubtedly baseball baptism boys. For several reasons, the total excommunications of baseball baptism converts may have reached or exceeded 100,000 throughout the entire LDS church. I'll skip. However, there's a larger historical perspective, and my estimate is that 90% of baseball baptism boys either rapidly went into inactivity and or were mass excommunicated. The perspective that needs to be placed into is that prior to the baseball baptism, those who were taught 18 lessons inflexibly before they were baptized during a five-year period before the baseball baptism period, 50% of those had left the church before the baseball baptism period even began. And the statistics generally for attrition after conversion to the LDS church is 50%, and I cite statistics for that. Also, the administrative reduction of Henry Dean Moyle did not damage the future church careers of the two pointmen in his building and baptism programs in 1959 to 1963. Wendell Mendenhall later became a regional representative of the 12. T. Bowring Woodbury became a member of the Church Missionary Committee. Other mission presidents also involved in Europe's baseball baptism program fared even more favorably. And Alden Tanner became an apostle, Alvin R. Dyer became a special apostle and special counselor of the First Presidency, Brockbank and Cullimore both became assistants to the 12, and then later members of the 70. The baseball baptism era was Henry D. Moyle's program, and the First Presidency obviously felt there should be no censure of those who carried out his instructions. On the rare occasions that LDS church leaders have acknowledged the abuses of the baseball baptism era, they have blamed the missionaries. After all, weren't those 19 and 20-year-olds the ones who baptized the unprepared, the untaught, the underaged, the bribed, the deceived, and the exploited? Weren't LDS missionaries the ones who forged baptismal certificates? Yes, but that is blaming the victims. Some missionaries who participated in the baseball baptisms may have been willing, even eager, but they were nonetheless the real victims of that era. The persons they took advantage of were objects of an exploitative I-it relationship for a few hours or less. The missionaries of the baseball baptism program were exploited constantly by their mission presidents for 2 years in a spiritually corrosive I-it relationship. And the most serious victims were those missionaries who didn't recognize that they were being spiritually abused. Unless they confront emotionally and spiritually the fact of their being abused, The abused often become abusers when they have the power to do so. This is true of abused church members, just as it is true of abused family members. Was the baseball baptism era an unparalleled aberration? Not from what a number of more recent LDS missionaries have told me, and I give you examples of that, but I won't go into that. This is the background to the statement of First Presidency Counselor Gordon B. Hinckley to mission presidents 10 years ago. Quote, "With all the powers of persuasion I am capable of, I plead with you to train and motivate your missionaries to the point of view that it is converts they are out to win, rather than numbers of baptisms for the sake of a good statistical record," unquote. A recent news article also shows that baseball baptisms are not a problem peculiar to Mormonism. A Baptist church in Colorado sponsored a carnival and then baptized all the children who attended under the pretense of, quote, water games, unquote. Such abuse of religious ordinances will occur whenever leaders or missionaries of any religion regard externals as more important than one's relationship with God. Church leaders who maintain an I-thou relationship with God will not require subordinates to have an I-it relationship with the church or its ordinances. All of us can benefit from remembering the example of those Mormon missionaries during the baseball baptism era who quietly maintained the integrity of their relationship with God despite overwhelming pressures to the contrary. No one who has an I-thou relationship will act or speak as if the gospel of Christ were a commodity, or regard converts as trophies. Nor, for that matter, will such an LDS leader treat church members as disposable property, to be discarded when the leader has grown weary of them. Those who have an I-thou relationship with God recognize that they themselves are no more important to God than the leper, the Down syndrome baby, the Pharisee, the thief, the excommunicated, the street beggar, the uneducated, or the libertine. God has an I-thou relationship with all his children, not just those who consider themselves righteous or his people. Thank you.
Like to thank Mike for the... Can you hear me okay? I could hear Mike just fine, but all of a sudden... Yes? Okay.
Hello, 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 hello.
Okay. Okay. I'd like to compliment Mike's paper, not only because I think it's a very important topic, but also for his attempt to relate it to a larger issue, what he calls the I-thou versus I-it. Conversions, another way that might be expressed is viewing people as equals rather than objects, perhaps. But I appreciate that part of it, as well as the documentation of a very important event, I think, in the history of the church. As a possible weakness might be a couple of them. First of all, I think that Mike's documentation of the specific abuses that he details at the end of the paper may well be in the final edition of the footnotes, but he doesn't do a real good job of documenting the most troubling abuses. Also, his sources included, as far as I could tell, relatively few of the missionaries who were personally involved. I don't know. I didn't get a sense for exactly how many of those, but just from the text of it and looking at his, glancing very quickly at his oral history, it seemed to me that they may have been underrepresented. If that's the case, then it's might be good that I'm was selected as a respondent to this paper, because I was directly or indirectly involved with the... for hundreds of what Mark E. Peterson called hasty baptisms in San Diego from 1978 to 1980. So I want to give you a little bit of that history before I discuss the specific issues that Mike deals with. I think to put my experience in context, I think it's important for me to go back to age 14 for me. When I was in junior high school, I met on an occasion or two with some students from the university who were part of Campus Crusade for Christ. We had one or two visits. Part of that, of those conversations, I sat down with one of the young men and went through a pamphlet called The Four Spiritual Laws. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's a very popular evangelistic pamphlet. And that conversation took maybe 10 or 15 minutes. At the end of it, there was a prayer in which I was invited to read this prayer or say this prayer and accept Jesus Christ as my personal Savior, which I did. At the end of that brief encounter, the student announced to his friends that we got another one. And that was basically the end of my relationship with those people. Now, I didn't mind being viewed, I think, as an acquisition. I don't know if it's fair to characterize it this way, but you might interpret it that way, certainly. At the time, I didn't mind it, and even looking back on it, I didn't feel particularly exploited that way, because I think that both that individual's and my, both of our relationships were primarily concerned with God rather than with each other. This person was acting in the evangelistic role as a missionary, not as the in the pastoral role, and I think that was understood. And I was very grateful for the time that he spent with me and for using that time to deliver a message, which has changed my life in many ways. That was a turning point in my spiritual life. I think it defined, in many ways, my understanding of religion as one that's essentially personal between the individual and God, rather than corporate or institutional. Also, I think I began to view the religious life as not entirely event related, but certainly punctuated by crucial events such as rebirth that can have an eternal influence on a person, rather than view the religious growth and development entirely from a view of a process that a person may go through. With that little foundation, I went to Venezuela on my mission. When I was in the language training mission, I think it was George Durant spoke to us and recommended Parley P. Pratt's autobiography, a wonderful book, which I purchased and read in the early days of my mission, and was struck with many things there. One thing in particular that I'd like to mention is that Parley P. Pratt describes his difficulty in finding someone who was willing to baptize him. Pratt had read the scriptures. He believed in the ordinance of baptism and its essential nature. But when he would appeal to the ministers of religion of his day, they required of him some sort of a experience of religion, as they called it. And he didn't have an experience of religion that fit into their mold, and so they refused to baptize him. And it was a very frustrating experience for Elder Pratt, and wasn't an elder at the time, obviously, for Parley Pratt, in that he couldn't find anyone to baptize him. And at that time, or maybe it was afterward, but that reading that experience, I think, had an influence on me and my decision to not deny anyone the blessing of baptism because of some extra scriptural requirement that I would place in the way. Once in Venezuela, I encountered a pervasive leadership emphasis in the missionary work. And this tended to rub me wrong. Any of the work with the poor or the less educated people, single people, women in particular, was discouraged. The church in Venezuela needs leaders, I was told, because it's a young the church hasn't been in Venezuela long, and we need leaders, and so we should concentrate on those who have the best leadership potential, which would include the well-educated, the wealthy, successful men especially, and their families. Teaching in lower-class neighborhoods was actually, well, in Venezuela they would actually be middle-class neighborhoods, was actually forbidden. And this, I think, ostensibly was for safety reasons, but it had the effect of keeping the majority of the population of Venezuela away from the teaching of the gospel. In addition to the majority being kept out for social, economic, or racial reasons, of course, this was before the revelation on the blacks and the priesthood, and so you're also discouraged from teaching anyone who had ancestry. I felt that others were being kept out of the church because of the extra qualifications that missionaries would many times require before accepting the people for baptism. We required people to have a testimony, to attend church, to meet the bishop or the branch president, to have all of the discussions, and there are various waiting periods that would frequently come into play. Now, these don't seem like unrealistic or unreasonable requirements. But my experience was that because of the emphasis on don't baptize someone in this case and don't baptize someone or don't teach someone in that case and make sure that, you know, that you don't skip any steps and so on, because the emphasis was on what not to do, it seemed that the slightest opposition or inconvenience would keep people from getting baptized, perhaps forever. And for one who believed that baptism by proper authority was essential for spiritual life and salvation, that was a real tragedy, both for the individual and for the kingdom of God, I believed. The teaching tended to focus on helping people get a testimony of Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, the Living Prophet, and the plan of salvation, by which they meant the premortal existence and the 3 degrees of glory. My emphasis started to change at this point, which is not an easy thing to do when you have set discussions, but every missionary tends to emphasize certain things, I think, and I tended to emphasize the first principles and ordinances of the gospel rather than getting a testimony of these other ideas. In other words, I emphasize faith in the atonement of Christ and repentance, baptism and confirmation by the restored authority. And I searched, it wasn't easy for me to do this because, for one thing, there were no pamphlets dealing with repentance in my mission. There were lots of Joseph Smith story kinds of pamphlets and pamphlets about the plan of salvation and that sort of thing, but not a pamphlet in Spanish about repentance. Actually, I was able to find one after searching for months, but I didn't have other copies that I could give out to investigators, so I had to get it back from people. And my mission president, Howard Marsh, was a kind and intelligent man, although I think most of the attitudes that I disagreed with in my mission probably went back to him. Still, he had an enlightened philosophy of missionary work. He always quoted, teach the missionaries correct principles and let them govern themselves, which I think was wonderful, except that, in my opinion, he never got around to teaching us those correct principles of missionary work. And nobody else in Venezuela seemed to know much about effective missionary work either, which was a real frustration to me because, more than anything else, I wanted to be a great missionary. I wanted to be a missionary like the ones I read about in the scriptures and in the early church history. I wanted to be like them who baptized hundreds and thousands of people. Now, why I wanted to be that kind of a great missionary, I suppose, is an open question. I don't think it was entirely for the reasons that Mike lists in his catalog of I-it motivations. I certainly didn't believe that I was adding to my glory with every convert that I had, or that I was, you know, those sorts of things were not part of my motivation. But I certainly was very motivated and had very strong desires in this way. Although I'm sure there were some mixture of selfish and unselfish motives. But I believed then, and I still do now as I look back on it, that my preeminent motivation was to build the kingdom of God and to give it a full consecrated effort. This, I think, illustrates perhaps a weakness in Mike's I-thou-I-it dichotomy, because it's not based on anything observable like the speed of the conversion process or activity rate or of the new members, etc., but rather on the internal state of affairs of the missionary, which is impossible for an outside observer, but I think it's also difficult even for the missionary himself or herself to determine. See which side of that dichotomy you're on. I don't think that makes it an invaluable measure, especially from a personal perspective. But that's a weakness of it, at least. Throughout most of my mission, I was frustrated by my own ignorance and the ignorance of those around me. I searched for ways of learning how to accomplish the kinds of things that I believed that missionaries could accomplish by reading the scriptures, etc. I found a book called Some Suggestions for LDS Missionaries, which was written by a salesperson, and it had some interesting suggestions, valuable in some of them, I think. Others seemed totally invaluable, like the Vitalic breath exercises that they recommended, where after your shower in the morning, you would sit with your legs spread in front of an open window and breathe in one nostril and exhale, and it was a... I didn't see much value in the Vitalic breath exercises, but there, at least here was someone who had a few suggestions that I found helpful in terms of teaching and persuading people to accept the gospel. Late in my mission, I came across a couple of things that I felt were clearly different than most of the material that circulated around the mission about how to help missionaries be effective missionaries. These were written by people not in Venezuela. Grant Harrison, who was a professor at BYU at the time and also the in charge of instruction at the missionary home in Salt Lake City, had written some articles for missionaries that I found very helpful. Also, David Farrell was a mission president in Ecuador and had some very innovative ways of working with pre-existing social and family structures in order to be more effective as a missionary. But these came so late in my experience in Venezuela that they were I didn't have much chance to get a handle on them. I'll skip what happened after my mission. Basically, let me mention one thing. A great opportunity from my perspective presented itself. My dad was called as a mission president in San Diego, California, about the same time that I was about to be released as a missionary. As some of you may know, mission presidents can call their own children on missions. My plan was to go straight from Venezuela to San Diego and have a second chance to implement the ideas that I was just beginning to get a handle on. And with two more years, I would certainly become the kind of missionary that I longed to be. Dad said no. So instead, I went to BYU, and I did look up Grant Harrison as soon as I got there, and some missionaries from the David Farrell's mission in Ecuador, and... spent a lot of time picking their brains and thinking about missionary work. Grant Harrison and I actually put together a little idea, which I presented to my dad and he accepted, which was for me to go to San Diego for just the summer between semesters and work as a missionary. So that's what I was able to do. I went to San Diego. I was given a companion who had originally been in David Farrell's mission in Ecuador, which I felt very fortunate about because he had seen some of the things that I wanted to do. He was sent to San Diego because he got sick in Ecuador. We worked in Encinitas, which is the north county of San Diego, which is a fairly affluent area. There are no Spanish-speaking barrios in the area. It's a fairly Anglo dominated population there. Most of the Spanish-speaking people lived as maids or as gardeners in the homes of the Anglos. So there weren't any large populations of people for us to work with, and I was quite frustrated by that. We did teach a couple of men who we met behind a Safeway store. Well, anyhow, the first month I was there, we did teach some people and have a few baptisms in the first month, and then in the second month I was there. This was going to be a four-month experience. We met some people that wanted to meet us behind the Safeway store, and we took them to the church to teach them. And after teaching them for a while, they accepted our invitation to baptism, and we asked about family or friends who might attend their baptismal service. They explained that they lived in a tomato field adjacent to the store with some friends, and we asked, how many did they have that we might invite? They said several hundred. That was an exciting event for me. because we realized that there might be opportunity here after all. We decided to have an outdoor baptismal service and invite everyone to attend. We got the other Spanish-speaking missionaries in the area to get the word out, and we held a large baptismal service at a beautiful fertilizer-induced green-colored spring out in the tomato field itself, which we dubbed the Waters of Gunnell for the name of my companion who found the place. Elder Gunnell, actually, after the baptism, had misgivings about following up on the incredible opportunity that now confronted us. We now had scores of interested people to teach, but there were also major difficulties and complications to deal with. These people were mostly men in their 20s and 30s. All were illegal aliens. So, by the way, had been everyone else that we had taught there in that area. But these people were transient. How could we keep track of them? How could they come to church and hold jobs and get the priesthood? They were certain to disappear as fast as we could baptize them. My response to Elder Gunnell was that God had led us to these people and that God would help us to deal with the problems as they arose. We had no choice but to work with these people. There were literally thousands of open-hearted people all around us who need the gospel. We can't turn our backs on them and pretend they're not here. That's how everyone else treats them. If the fields are where the people are, then that's where we need to go. Well, I prevailed, and during the next few weeks, we had a few more baptismal services there at the Waters of Gunnell. Then I was transferred to a small border town in the Imperial Valley for what was to be my third month. And I won't go into detail there, but we baptized maybe 20 people or so in this town of Calexico, while Elder Gunnell and his companions there on the coast had quite a few more conversions than that working in the fields. During my last month in San Diego, we began organizing branches in the fields of the North County, while other missionaries began having success among the Anglo population. Notably, some sister missionaries baptized dozens of servicemen on the Marine base. We found that teaching small groups worked better than large groups, and that teaching people at the meeting house was better than in the field. We developed an abbreviated discussion that covered all the essentials in about 2 hours, because it was hard for us to follow up on a second meeting with people. On a subsequent day. And so we felt that if we could teach them all in one spot and then baptize them, then that would work better. So we'd go into the field in the afternoon. We'd get several carloads of people. We'd bring to the church, and we'd teach them all afternoon. And then when we finished teaching them, we'd hold interviews, and we'd baptize everyone who's willing to be baptized that same night. Those who weren't ready could come back another night for the same instruction, assuming we could find them again. At this point, I returned to BYU. That was the end of my 4 months. But the work continued at an accelerating pace in San Diego. When I returned at Christmas time, San Diego had become the top baptizing mission in the church. This was not a goal of ours specifically. It's just something that we discovered sort of after the fact. The missionaries I had worked with and others had each, some of them, baptized hundreds of people by this point. Elder Gunnell was having misgivings again, and this time I could see why. One elder told me that some of the people he had baptized weren't sure what church they had joined. They called it the Church of the Brothers, because that's how we called them, you know, hermanos. He admitted that he had jokingly claimed to be an immigration agent in order to persuade some reluctant men to get in the car and come to the church to be taught. At this point, the missionaries weren't just teaching field workers. A popular approach was to go to the border and wait for a group of people to jump the fence and then pick them up and take them to the church to be taught and baptized and then kind of drop them off and let them go on their way. My response to these tactics was that we shouldn't be deceptive. We shouldn't baptize people who don't know what church they're joining. But we ought to, I guess, to borrow Brother Moyle's phrase, not put on the brakes either. And that we could make these corrections as time went on. I later learned of other creative but troubling approaches, or one in particular used by one of my former companions. He had met in his work a coyote, which is a person who smuggles people across the border. This coyote operated a bus, you know, a full-size bus in which he would do this. And the elder invited him to use the church parking lot as a waiting place until the immigration checkpoint on the freeway up the road was closed for the evening, each evening. This gave the coyote an ideal cover, and it gave the missionary a constant stream of people to teach and baptize. When my dad, who was the mission president, heard of this elder's coyote program, as he called it, he stopped it immediately. But in general, Dad was aware and supportive of the work that was going on. He also resisted the efforts of Mark Peterson and others to try to stop work with the wetbacks or other hasty baptisms. They, of course, had their way, that's Elder Peterson and company, had their way when after Dad was released at the end of his three-year term. And I would like to draw a couple of comparisons with Mike's paper on baseball baptisms here, because there are some very striking and troubling comparisons. I think the basic similarity was that we were working with the people with whom we had an imbalance of power between the missionaries and the converts. And in certain cases, that imbalance came to be exploited. Not in all cases, but it certainly was in many cases. I think that's the basic similarity that we see here, and probably in all of the cases that Mike has talked about in his paper that he didn't have a chance to read. Differences, I think, were also important to note, however. While the baseball baptisms was a top-down experience dictated from above and kind of enforced on the missionaries, ours was definitely a bottom-up initiative. My dad sort of went along with this, but he didn't initiate it, certainly. It was internally motivated by the missionaries rather than externally imposed upon them. Also, the environment in the missionary among the missionaries and in the mission itself was, I think, much different. This was not an oppressive environment. It was a very open environment for the missionaries themselves. This was a joyous time for us, because we felt like we were fulfilling prophecy. We felt like we were obeying the scriptures that teach that if a missionary has faith and works diligently, that he can bring, or she can bring, thousands of souls unto repentance. Also, President Kimball had given a number of talks calling for the day when missionaries would bring thousands of souls into repentance. And so this was a very wonderful time. There was not a competitive spirit in our mission as in the missions that Mike documents, either between the missionaries themselves or between our mission and other missions. It was a very cooperative experience for us. And so I think that those are important distinctions to make. However, abuses definitely did take place. Now, let me just ask some questions now, because I don't have answers to all of these. But I'm wondering, for one thing, how we might distinguish between an I-thou and an I-it conversion. It's easy to recognize the extremes. But most of us, I think, in our relationships with other people are somewhere in the middle, and it's a little more difficult to distinguish between, which of these poles we're leaning toward. I think most relationships have a give-and-take element. They have both. And certainly not the speed of the baptism or the activity rate of the converts afterwards, or the number of baptisms are I think, very good measures of whether the missionary is involved in an I-thou or an I-it kind of relationship. Another question I have is whether all proselytizing itself is inherently exploitive. I think that there are probably people here in the room who would take that position. That there's a sort of spiritual imperialism implicit in assuming that you have something to teach somebody else about God. And might it not be better if our missionaries just serve people's very real physical needs and let them keep their own faith? I think that's a valid question. And the answer to that question is going to depend, I think, on your own view of religion and whether you view that you have something valuable to share. Where's the line between persuasion, which, if missionary work is acceptable, legitimate activity, then persuasion, I think, is one of those activities that is acceptable according to Doctrine and Covenants. But how do we draw the line between persuasion and manipulation on the part of the missionary, or between humility and vulnerability on the part of the investigator? An interesting case in point is my own mother, who joined the church as a result of missionaries, and she was in a very vulnerable situation. My father obviously did too, but he was away when the missionaries knocked on the door. She was a brand new move-in. She was displaced from all of her support groups. She was a young married woman, had brand new children. Her husband was away. She was in a very vulnerable situation. And the missionaries used what might be considered a mildly deceptive approach. They came to the door and knocked on the door and said that they were doing a survey. And they were just interested in finding out what people believed about religion. Anyhow, these sorts of situations exist where people are vulnerable. And we've found that people are most receptive to the gospel when they're in these situations. How about the motives of the missionary? Is a mixture of motives on the part of the missionary or a mixture of incentives on the part of the convert all bad? Or is it impossible? I mean, is it avoidable? A case in point might be the Perpetual Immigration Fund, which I don't know, Mike might be able to answer this question. If that had any influence on the very dramatic conversions that took place in the early part of the dispensation in England. Certainly that there are always going to be a mixture of motives on both the part of the investigator and the missionary. And how do we sort that through? Can they be avoided altogether? Is baptism mostly about joining a church, or is it mostly between the individual and God? What's the spiritual cost of not baptizing someone? I leave those questions just open. Let me make some conclusions. First of all, I think Mike undervalues the role of the evangelist in the gospel. This may be inadvertent, but I think he associates the I-thou role with the pastoral missionary and the I-it role with the evangelistic missionary. And I don't think that's supportable. The itinerant preacher, whose role is to gather the elect, to harvest the field, be a fisher of men, that's the evangelist, and I think Mike prefers the role of the pastor who cares for the flock. But each role is valuable, I believe, and one should not say to the other, I have no need of thee. Not only does the church need evangelists, but so do the converts. Pastors get so involved in the detail of people's lives that they never get back out into the field to teach the multitudes who are still waiting to hear the gospel. We need those people who can preach the gospel, bring about a commitment to the gospel, and then move on to someone else and preach the multitudes that would never hear the message otherwise. I think for Mike, the question of how great shall be your joy if you should bring many souls unto me is not a rhetorical question. I think his joy would actually be greater with the long-term relationship with the save it be one soul that you should bring unto me, as the paraphrasing the scripture. And I think that's wonderful. But I think we should not deny the validity of the other role, which may be just as sincere and caring in its own way. I think your joy can be great with many souls, as well as with the one. But in order for that to happen, you have to leave the flock and go out into the field and seek more. I think Mike's I-thou dichotomy is good for personal introspection. To say that an activity is exploitive is possible, but I don't know that you can say that a missionary's motives are with any degree of certainty, and I think that that's the heart of this dichotomy that Mike is presenting. And let me just finalize with a couple of suggestions for what I would consider to be productive, sustainable proselyting. I believe in a laissez-faire missionary approach. I think that that's best. I think abuses and overzealousness should be corrected on a case-by-case basis to avoid overreactions. I believe that quotas are inappropriate, and goals, however, are generally valuable, but I think that too much goal-centeredness should be watched out for. I think Mike is right in saying that goals can be carried too far. I think competitiveness is totally inappropriate in a missionary setting. One-visit conversions, I think, should be the exception, not the rule, but I don't think that they should be outlawed entirely. We have too many examples in the scriptures and in our history where people hear the gospel and respond immediately. I don't think we ought to make a program of it, though. I believe that for those converts who are ready to answer the missionary's call, a two-week conversion time is perhaps a good average. Obviously, some people will take much, much longer, and my role as a missionary in the evangelistic mode was to leave those people and look for someone who was ready to respond. And I don't think that's inappropriate. I believe that we should let missionaries follow their own gifts. Let the pastors pastor and let the evangelist evangelize. We ought to value both. We ought to be aware, and I think this is the crucial point here, of power imbalances that exist between missionaries and converts, and take extra time and care in those situations. After evaluating, and this has been a valuable experience for me, my own experience and feelings, I conclude that missionary work can have an extraordinary value. Even evangelistic missionary work can be very valuable, both for the collective kingdom of God and for the individual. It can also be destructive to both. I'm grateful both to those people who have shown me how it can be done, and also to Mike for showing me how it shouldn't be done. Thank you.
I'd like to suggest a procedural plan. Time is running out, and I think there are probably some of you, maybe many of you, who would like to raise a question or make a comment. Since there is no other program scheduled to come into this space immediately, I'm going to ask both Brother Quinn and Brother Rector if they will stay as long as there are interested people who want to interact with them, and like to suggest to the rest of you that you feel free and unembarrassed to depart whenever the Spirit moves. I think our next move, however, should be to allow Michael to make any comments he would like to make in response to Daniel's presentation.
My response would only be brief in that I probably failed to outline clearly enough that I don't see the itinerant missionary as preferable to the pastoral missionary. It's just a different kind of missionary. Paul was primarily an itinerant. There were times in his ministries when he was pastoral, but for the most part he was itinerant. He would rush into a city and preach for a day or two and then leave, and after baptizing, and sometimes people had already been taught by others and he would baptize them. Other times he would teach and somebody else would baptize, but he was very often on the run, either from authorities or just on the run to fields white for the harvest. And yet his letters demonstrate this enormous interest, devotion that he had to the people whom he had taught, and to those that he had encountered, and those that he knew others had encountered. So I did not intend to establish a priority that the pastoral was better than the itinerant. I did establish that no matter what kind of missionary, or at least I meant to establish that no matter what kind of missionary you are, whether it is an itinerant or whether it is a pastoral, you can still have an I-it relationship. And there were many of those Franciscan priests in those missions who were real bastards, whose goals were not for the welfare of their their charges. And simply being a pastoral minister does not guarantee that you're going to regard people as the children of God and that your relationship is one with them of love. And merely because you race into town and teach somebody and race out a day later does not mean that you have regarded that person as an object. That person and their welfare may be in your thoughts and prayers for the rest of your life, even though you may never see them. So I have to admit guilt to the claim or the observation that this is not something you can determine externally. That was my whole point, that it is an internal issue and that it's not the means, it isn't the time period, it isn't the type of missionary. It is the relationship that that missionary has with the Lord and with that person, and it is the relationship that that person has in his or her conversion. And it's not only conceivable, I think it's a reality that there are converts who have an I-it relationship in their conversion. They join because they want the missionary to like them, or they join for very objective reasons, and the missionary is totally devoted to that person and has a completely I-thou relationship with the person, and the person being converted has totally an objective reason for being baptized, that they want the privileges of the church or whatever. And for them, the conversion process is an object. For the missionary, it's totally a relationship, and vice versa. So it's not something that can be told from the outside, and I'll have to plead guilty to not making that clear enough. And before this is published, I hope to improve on that. And that's really all I have to comment in terms of my reaction. I'd like to give the rest of the time for questions or comments.